Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey there, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you?
Chipper.
You know, I read in USA Today recently.
Oh, actually, you know, this article came to us through the newsroom brought this article to us because they thought it was too ridiculous for them to talk about.
The news department.
Mike Pavlichko brought this article to us last week.
Mike Pavlichko of WCTC Radio passed this bit of news scooping over to the restaurant side. Thank you, Mike Pavlichko. I'm looking here at a number of cheeseburger ideas which were brought up recently that didn't work.
No, some of them worked. Some of them are working. Some of them, people are eating these things.
Well, it's America, man. This is the home of, I don't know, this is the home of, what is that? What is that reality show where people eat bugs?
Fear Factor.
There you go. Here's some Fear Factor food for you, everybody. Cheeseburger on a donut.
Crispy cream cheeseburger. Here's what they're doing at this minor league baseball team. They're cutting Krispy Kremes in half. Then they're
half long ways, like to make two.
Right, to make
half
a right,
donuts
right,
with
right.
Holes in them.
To make donut with right, exactly. To make them into a buns. Okay, and they're putting a cheeseburger between them with the sticky side down so you don't get too messy.
With the sugar side against
sugar
the burger.
Sugar side against the burger to create what clearly is one of the most disgusting, worst for you foods on the planet today.
I'm looking at a picture of it. The cheeseburger donuts, the Gateway Grizzlies, an independent baseball league in Saugat, Illinois, started selling baseball's best burger, I doubt it, this month. $4.50 a cheeseburger with two strips of bacon grilled between sliced Krispy Kreme donuts. It comes to the plate with 1,000 calories, 45 grams of fat, but the Grizzlies are selling 150 a game.
1,000 calories.
That's
okay.
Half your diet. That's, you have two of them, you're done for
but
the
day. Seriously, okay, if I want a cheeseburger and a donut, I don't want it all at once. Okay. I want two nice, fun, tasty, bad-for-me things.
Do you remember when your mom told you you couldn't go swimming for 45 minutes after you had it eaten?
Yeah.
Well, that turns out not to be true, but you shouldn't have a donut for 45 minutes after you have a cheeseburger. They're two great tastes that do not taste great together. I'm looking with the bacon.
Oh, it's sugar, salty, fried thing.
But wait, there's more. Uno Chicago Grill launched a bacon cheeseburger deep dish pizza. It's a deep dish pizza topped with 6 ounces of grilled ground beef, pickles, mustard, and ketchup.
Okay, hold on. I'm okay. Ready? You're going to put on my pizza ground beef. All right. Okay, that's fine. You know, sometimes
how do you feel about
beef.
Pickles?
Bacon? I'm okay with bacon on my pizza. All right, bacon, little chopped meat, little bacon.
Pickles.
All right, you didn't go too far. And there you've gone too far. And then you want to take it a little farther? Let's put some ketchup on my pizza. Where do you live?
Middle America.
Come on. Middle America listens to this show. And let me tell you something. Anybody who's putting ketchup on their pizza who's listening to this broadcast, email me so I can make fun of you.
Turn off your radio. We don't want you. We don't want you as listeners.
You're fired as a listener if you do that.
Cheeseburger egg rolls, promotion by Bennigan's, that bastion of culinary innovation. $6.99 appetizer sizzled so it gets a permanent slot in July, says Clay Dover, vice president of marketing. It's an egg roll stuffed with ground beef, cheese, there we are again, pickles, onions, and mustard.
Okay, once again, I'm going to say.
And then deep fried.
It's the pickles, the onions, and the mustard that
and your
really
egg roll?
Are messing me up.
Yeah, those are the ones that
and
I...
And that's... Can I... You know, Francis, you know this about me. I love fried foods, okay? I love them, all right? But can we stop putting every food on the planet into the deep fryer, okay? I understand, okay, corn dogs, okay, that was kind of a cool idea, all right? It was kind of a cool idea, all right, corn dogs, all right, that's not so bad. Twinkies.
Yeah. Have you heard about this?
You went over the top.
You out there in listener land, have you heard about this? Twinkies?
Fried Twinkies.
Fried Twinkies.
Okay, Jennifer, my wife and kids were just at one of those little carnivals, okay? And she came back and she said, new low. I just had a new low in food for me of all time.
Did she try one?
No. The new carnival like goodie.
What is it?
Fried Oreos, batter dipped like in a funnel cake batter. Fried Oreos.
How was it?
Ew. She came back. She was like, not so good. Can I just have an Oreo? Can I just have one of the Oreos, please?
And oh my. Well, let's talk about some good food.
Okay.
Let's talk about some.
Is there any left on the planet? Is what I want to know.
Because
I keep seeing cheeseburger tacos and cheeseburger fingers and cheeseburger salads. And Francis and I, one of the good things that we can talk about is cheeseburgers.
Yeah.
Okay? One of the reasons it's one of the most popular foods in the United States is because it's nearly perfect.
Yeah.
Stop messing with it.
And when you cook your cheeseburgers at home, everybody has a little trick for cheeseburger. You got to make the cheeseburger kind of thick.
Mm-hmm.
You got to use good ground beef, and for all you foodies, this is obvious, but for those of you who aren't foodies, don't buy the leanest ground beef you can get. The flavor comes from fat, okay? And so you want to buy not very lean beef to make a good burger.
The other thing that I want to tell people, if you have a local butcher, if you have somebody who will ground beef for you.
Grind.
Beef into ground beef for you. How's that? who will grind beef for you. Use that butcher. Frankly, you can get little bits and pieces, and if you have a KitchenAid mixer, for about $30, there's a grinder on there. If you can grind your own meat, why do you have to cook a burger to well or medium well in order to eat it? Why is that recommended by a lot of people? Well, it's recommended because the pathogens on meat generally are on the outside of the meat, okay, whether it's the outside of the chicken or the outside of the beef, and you have to get that beef to a certain temperature on the outside because most of anything that's happened bad has happened either due to handling or things that are on the outside of the meat. That's why the inside of a steak can be red, nearly raw, and people are recommending that the inside of a burger shouldn't be raw because it's ground. Well, if it's freshly ground, if you're grinding it, if you know the conditions in your own kitchen and you've kept everything clean and sterile, if you're standing there watching your butcher grind you just saw him put new gloves on and you trust this butcher's cleanliness, well, then you can have those burgers to rare or medium rare and you don't have to worry about cooking them as much. The key is trusting from where your beef comes and then you don't have to worry as much about the pathogens.
Here's a little trick that some people who want to make their burgers a little more flavorful do. They throw in a little extra fat into the grind. And I know one guy who throws a little bit of duck fat into his ground beef.
Nice.
And let me tell you something. It's delicious.
I mean, and I'm not blowing our own horn here, but our burger, the burger at the restaurant did win best cheeseburger in New York City from City Search before they banned us for being
not from New York,
35 miles outside of New York. But besides that, don't be afraid of putting a little fat in your burger, and don't mess with it once it's on the grill, okay? Don't keep flipping it and flipping it and flipping it. And get burger from a place that you trust so you can have it rare or medium rare or even medium. And the same way you would have your steak, hopefully you can eat your burgers that way.
Well, so there's a little burger advice from the Restaurant Guys. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Cafe and Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest is Sean Harrison. Now, Sean is one of only 22 master distillers of gin in the world. He's master distiller at Plymouth Gin in Plymouth, England, and he joins us from there today to talk about gin in general. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the show.
Hi, hello. Thanks so much for letting me on.
But wouldn't have it any other way. Now, Plymouth Gin, we didn't see much of in the United States, or at least around New York until recently, and it's really been resurgent in the last, five, 7 years or so with the cocktail craze.
In 1999, we certainly saw Plymouth Gin kind of come back. You want to tell us about how and why that happened?
Yeah, quite strange, really, because Plymouth Gin is actually 213 years old, but over the last 50 years, we've had a little bit of a checkered history, unfortunately, and it's only really within the last 10 years that's been turned around.
So what was checkered? What went right? What goes right? What goes wrong?
Yeah, tell us about the little red spaces and the little black spaces.
Yeah. Basically, unfortunately for gin, the Second World War got in the way, because if you look at the history of gin before the Second World War, with the cocktail craze of like the 20s and 30s, you know, gin was the in drink, and with the sort of Second World War arriving, most of the ingredients that we use are actually come from Europe, and most of the markets that we sell to are exported. And suddenly both of those got a little bit difficult for 6 years. And then with the end of the war and business trying to reestablish itself and sort of trying to get Europe getting itself going again, it took about 10 years or so. And within that sort of 15-year period, really, Plymouth Gin died quite hugely, really. And the family, unfortunately, didn't have enough money after the war to reinvest and start the business going again. And we disappeared into corporate hands.
And then, when you say you disappeared into corporate hands, did the recipe change? Did the quality go down? What happened to the gin itself?
The quality dipped during the war years, without a shadow of a doubt. Everybody that I've spoken to that sort of drank Plymouth gin during the Second World War was saying that it just got worse and worse as the war went on. So basically people stopped drinking it. And once the sort of the business or the sort of Europe started to get back on its feet, unfortunately for gin, vodka became fashionable.
Now let's talk about gin versus vodka, because you may not realize out there in listener land, if you go to the temples of the cocktail, say in...
Hold on. You realize this if you listen to this show, because
yeah,
Francis is constantly proselytizing about gin
if you go to serious cocktail places in New York, if you talk to Dale DeGroff or Gary Regan, or if you go to the Pegu Club, or if you go to Employees Only or Angel's Share, they'll have lists of cocktails based in whiskey. They'll have lists of cocktails based in gin. But, you know, the vodka is sort of kept under the bar like a dirty magazine. You know, you need to ask for it. And
it's the rare cocktail that has vodka.
And that's because, you know, people say, oh, well, I prefer vodka over gin. Vodka, legal definition, flavorless alcoholic beverage. I mean, and if you don't like alcoholic beverages, vodka is your choice.
But all vodkas aren't flavorless anymore.
But once you put them in a cocktail, they disappear. All right. But gin really has its own personality. Sean, will you tell us how gin is made and why gin is so much more flavorful than the other clear spirit vodka?
Yeah, because gin is a recipe. If you look at actually what gin is, we take very neutral alcohol. That very neutral alcohol, we can actually put it into a bottle and call it vodka. So gin is the original flavored vodka.
So basically, you're saying that vodka is incomplete gin.
Yes, it's halfway to God's world, basically.
Uh-huh.
But the big difference really with gin is that the legal definition of gin is that juniper has to be the largest single flavoring ingredient.
Now, juniper, tell us what juniper is.
Juniper is a berry. It's a small sort of tree, sort of bush-like plant that's part of the pine family of trees.
Mm-hmm.
And it grows about sort of 3,000 feet, or ideally it grows about 3,000 feet up on the side of a hill. It likes a bit of sun. It likes a bit of cold weather. And it's been known about for centuries. Originally, when juniper first came on the scene, you're talking about 800 or 900 years ago, and it was being used to make medicines. And it's only really when you get to the 1600s that somebody actually took juniper and alcohol and called it gin.
Mm-hmm.
And then recipes became more refined. So, for instance, we use six other ingredients, which make 7 in total. And that produces a flavor profile. And the analogy is very much either like perfume or like cooking. It's about balancing flavors, but on alcohol. And that's what makes gin the different drink to lots of other drinks.
And one of the things that's really interesting and I think great about gin, and much more so than vodka, is the different flavor profiles that different gin have.
Different houses of gin.
And what Sean just said was there are different recipes, and every house has their different recipe for how their gin is made and what the botanicals that go into their gin are. And if you like a very heady gin, there are certain gins for that. And if you like a lighter style of gin, there are certain gins for that, and a whole broad array of different styles and different brands of gin.
Which is why, fellow cocktailians, that people want to use gins in cocktails and in a quality place. When people use or come up with a cocktail recipe or recreate an old cocktail recipe, they'll be very, very specific about the gin that's used in that cocktail recipe because it's a very specific and different ingredient. Now, do you see your gin being used in, or do you like that your gin is used in cocktails?
I love the fact that my gin is used in cocktails. I've been asked this question quite a few times, and some people say that, you know, don't you as a distiller find that if people are adulterating your product when they mix it in cocktails? I'm the exact opposite. I think it's great that somebody wants to use the product that I make in a drink and to try and work around the flavors and to make more interesting and more varied drinks. Because if you just drank gin neat all of the time, then you would probably find you'd lose interest in it.
We never lose interest in gin, much to my mother's chagrin. We'll be back in just a moment. Our guest is Sean Harrison. He's one of only 22 master distillers of gin in the world, and we're talking with him specifically about Plymouth gin, which is what he distills, but other gins as well. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
Today we are proud to present Jackie Naylor.
Once upon a time, New Year's Eve was a night for swank jazz, champagne, and caviar. Ring in 2007 at just such a gathering with us. The Restaurant Guys present a New Year's Eve jazz concert at the Crossroads Theater starring Ms. Jackie Naylor. Jackie's been called the new voice of jazz by Vogue magazine. Jazz Times says, in the never-ending Next Big Thing sweepstakes, bet on Jackie Naylor. She's headlined internationally. She's played with Michael McDonald and David Sanborn. And on New Year's Eve, she'll play to a sold-out crowd at the Crossroads Theater right next to our restaurants. Dine before or after the show at either one of our acclaimed restaurants. There are hotel accommodations within walking distance. One of the best jazz singers in the country. Two of the best restaurants in the state. An evening not to be forgotten. Go to stageleft.com or Catherine Lombardi.com for details, reservations, and menus, or call 732-828-4444. Put the swank back in New Year's Eve. Spend it with the Restaurant Guys. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And our guest is Sean Harrison. He is master distiller at Plymouth Gin, which is one of our favorite gins, believe it or not. You'll find it on the back bar of both Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. We use it in a number of our cocktails, of our classic cocktails in Catherine Lombardi at our cocktail bar. And Sean, we were talking about cocktails and gin. I mean, in England, where we're talking to you from England, cocktails are really, I mean, they say that for a long time the number one city in the world for cocktails was New York, especially with the resurgence of cocktails in the 80s with Dale de Groff. But London, I hear, is now pretty much the preeminent cocktail city in the world.
It's really kind of caught fire in London.
Yeah, definitely. London has sort of taken over the lead, really. And I think a lot of that is because the interest of barmen in the UK has been captured by cocktails. And the willingness to want to learn about them is really quite strong in the UK. The big difference, really, between sort of the cocktail scene in the UK and America is that you can pretty much walk into any bar in the US, and they've probably got an idea about making cocktails, whereas in the UK, it's really only the top-end bars. If you were to walk into a normal pub, they would look at you oddly if you asked for a cocktail.
Right, you order a pint and a whiskey, and that's
exactly.
It.
Exactly. So you've got to be a little bit careful which ones you walk into. But what's happened, really, in the UK is because it's captured the imagination, they've taken cocktails and they want to use fresh ingredients and they want to use high-class products, and they want to learn about all the products. So it's not just about gin. They want to know about rum, about whiskey, about tequila, and they've got a real interest in the subject. And the passion in London about cocktails is just huge.
And if you look at, I mean, a clear example to us of that is, you know, our friends who are on the high end of the cocktail game in New York are constantly flying over to London, either mm-hmm. because they're hired to do things or they're working on projects over there.
Or they're opening new cocktail bars.
Yeah. But now, the thing about cocktails, as we're talking about them, however, and I want everybody to understand this, is cocktails are like food, and the reason that people in New York, people coined the term bar chef, there's a difference between the quote-unquote martini bar that uses a flavored vodka and Goldschlager and a vanilla vodka and a raspberry vodka and an apple pucker.
Cocktails are never blue.
To make something, you know, I guess there's a little thing we have written in our cocktail menu. It says apple pucker is to cocktails what Twinkies are to cake. You know, we're talking about real ingredients, and Plymouth gin and using gin as a base means it is one of those. You are taking something seriously. Whereas when you use vodka as a base, you use vodka as a base because you really don't want it to taste like anything, I think, and you just want it to taste like the juice or whatever it is that you put in it. We're going to come back right after the news and talk more with Sean Harrison. He's speaking to us from Plymouth, England, where he is the master distiller of gin at Plymouth Gin, one of our favorites. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Our guest today is Sean Harrison. He is one of only 22 master distillers in the world, and he's a master distiller at Plymouth Gin. He joins us from Plymouth, England, to talk about gin and the resurgence of this great house. Now, we were talking before the news about how Plymouth Gin has for hundreds of years been one of the best gins or the most recognizable gins coming out of England. It was the official gin and remains the official gin of the Royal Navy. Is that correct?
Yes, we have a very good association with the Royal Navy.
Now, after World War II, though, we got into trouble. We weren't making as high a quality gin. It wasn't being as widely drunk. What happened to bring Plymouth Gin back, and what makes a gin a great gin as opposed to the industrial product it had become?
Oh, gosh, now there's a long question in itself.
You got 9 minutes.
The reason we came back is the company was sold by one of the big corporations to four individuals that really wanted to make it happen. So basically, they started pushing and reselling Plymouth Gin and getting out there and marketing it again. There has never been anything really wrong with the gin. For 213 years, other than the Second World War, there's been absolutely nothing wrong with the gin. So as soon as they started to reestablish it, then people started picking up on it again. And also, if you look at Plymouth Gin, if you go back 100 years, it's like Plymouth Gin is recognized in the very first dry martini recipe from 1896. If you then look in the great cocktail books, like the Savoy cocktail books from the 1930s, Plymouth Gin is listed in there 27 times. So actually you suddenly appreciate that actually 80 to 100 years ago, they really understood Plymouth Gin. So it's just the last few years really about sort of getting it out there again, putting it in front of people and saying, hey, look at this gin. And then we back up our our product by entering as many competitions as we can really to so that we can be judged by our peers, so that our peers recognize how good the gin is.
Has the recipe been the same throughout the whole time?
It has. The recipe is 213 years old, basically. And we probably make it slightly different today in the fact that we put a lot more effort in choosing the ingredients to keep the consistency. So we apply more science to it that wasn't available 213 years ago. But the actual recipe and the actual makeup of what we're trying to do is exactly the same.
Now, is all of the Plymouth Gin pot still?
It is, yeah. It's all batch distilled in a pot still.
Why don't you tell people the difference between pot stilled and column stilled and how much more difficult pot distillation is?
Pot still really, and the sort of the crux really of gin is we are flavoring alcohol. So we put into a pot still, which is an onion-shaped still, alcohol and water and then the seven ingredients. And what we're doing is we're cooking out, we're extracting the essential oils out of the ingredients and attaching it to the alcohol. And that's something you can't do in a column still because the column still works in reverse. The column still is trying to take off flavor, whereas we're trying to add it.
Just so everybody knows out there, what a column still is, column distillation was a very cheap way to distill, and it's the way most liquor is distilled
it's
today.
It's still a very cheap way to distill.
And it's a way to constantly put something in the bottom of this long column, and then you basically have baffles that heat it up, and so the steam rises to the top, and you get the alcohol out of the top. And so you constantly have an inflow of raw material, and you constantly have an outflow of the finished, you know, cheaper product. A pot still is the way that things have always been distilled. It's just you take a pot and you heat that pot up and then you have to stop and empty it and clean it and start again. A much more artisanal way to make any spirit. And there are very few gins that are pot still. Isn't that correct?
The top end gins tend to be pot still. The rest, you've got to be a little bit careful when you see a gin in the shop. The first thing you need to look for is the word distilled. If it doesn't say distilled on the label, then you need to be looking on the back to see how it's made, because that's a key word in the whole process.
Mm-hmm. And if it's not distilled, it's just infused?
Or somebody has tipped essence of into a vat of alcohol, basically.
Which is basically just dropping flavoring into a vat of alcohol.
Yes, precisely.
We'll call it the Kool-Aid method of making gin.
Now, when we see a good gin versus a bad gin, what do you look for in the flavor profile of a good gin versus a gin that you think is substandard? What goes wrong when you find a gin that you don't think is a very good one?
You're looking for something that excites the taste buds in more than one area. The thing about essential oils is that they get into your nose and they get onto your palate, because theoretically we can only taste sweet, sour, salt, bitter. So what the flavors do is they enliven those areas of the tongue, and then the smells get into your nose. So you're looking for more than one particular taste, and the more the better, really. And that's really the difference between good gins and less good gins.
Hmm.
Besides the Kool-Aid gins that you discussed earlier.
Exactly. They, if it doesn't say distilled on the bottle or it doesn't even hint at it, don't go anywhere near it.
You know, I think that one of the interesting things about I sat in a focus group in the last couple of months, put together by my friend Dale DeGroff, who's a preeminent cocktail, and you can find his book on our website as well. And it was these people bringing in a high-end vodka, I don't know, from somewhere in Eastern Europe, and we sat on a tasting panel with seven of the commercially available high-end gins in New York and this one, and we did them all blind.
Vodkas.
And it was vodkas, and we did them all blind. And they actually did reasonably well on the tasting panel. It was me and seven other people, like top cocktail people from New York and writers and the like. And at the end, they asked for our input beyond just what the vodkas tasted like. And we said, well, our input is, you know, and they said, one of the questions is, what would it take for you to recommend this vodka or any vodka to a customer? And all of us, everyone around the table said, I don't recommend vodkas to customers. People decide what vodka they're going to drink based on a magazine ad they've seen before they walked into your bar, and no one is going to change. No one's going to ask you. And because there are so slight differences between the two, or between the however many vodkas there are, you're never going to get someone to recommend a vodka. And frankly, the other thing we said is, when people drink vodka in cocktails, now maybe not as a martini, but they drink vodka in cocktails, if you took your average vodka drinker with a brand loyalty and swapped his vodka for another one, he probably wouldn't know in his vodka and cranberry juice. But in all of our cocktails, if you took a gin drinker with a brand loyalty and you swapped his gin for another...
You took the Plymouth out and put Hendricks in or Bombay in...
Or a cheap one in especially, he would come right back at you. Do you think that's a valid assessment of the situation?
Oh, definitely. I know people, because all gins are different, you can get completely different drinks by changing the gin. And I would also agree that one gin does not fit every single cocktail.
Sure.
Gin cocktails are designed for what that specific gin is bringing to that cocktail, which is why, for instance, the Gimlet is actually originally a Plymouth gin cocktail. The pink gin is originally a Plymouth gin cocktail. And, you know, my little hobby horse is there's no such thing as a vodka martini. You know,
right.
Basically, it's a martini because it's gin in the glass.
Well, basically. Sir, I think that if you came to Jersey and found yourself with the chocolate martinis that we have surrounding us, you would find yourself very upset.
Or the apple pucker martinis, exactly.
Exactly.
Or
yeah.
The blue curacao.
Ladies and gentlemen,
martini-like.
A martini
substances.
Has two ingredients, possibly three: gin, sweet vermouth, and maybe some orange bitters if you want to be a little retro. So, why did James Bond switch over?
It's one of the most annoying things, right? I have no idea.
He's a Brit, for God's sake. Why did he switch over?
And one of the odd things is Ian Fleming was a known Plymouth gin drinker. So, but actually what he was doing, he was just making James Bond fashionable. When he was writing all the books in the sort of late 50s, vodka was becoming on the scene. And actually the original James Bond cocktail is a Vespa, which is a gin and vodka-based cocktail.
You know, if you want to know just how geeky we are, you can come to Catherine Lombardi and order a Vespa, and we'll make you one. But go ahead. I didn't know that, actually. I had forgotten it, but we have it on our cocktail menu. But go
basically
ahead.
What happened is a Russian colleague or friend or lover died, so he took the gin out in deference to that person. And obviously it sounds better to say shaken, not stirred. So suddenly you get this wonderful sort of myth around a martini that is just totally untrue.
Well, and also, the whole shaken martini thing, I want everyone who's listening to pay attention.
Yeah,
stop doing that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there's an old adage, I forget how it goes, something like, you know, if it has juice in it, it should smile at you or sparkle at you, but if it's just liquor, just stir the damn thing and leave it alone.
Is that the old adage? Exactly?
No, I'll have to look it up.
Because I'm pretty sure that's not exactly how it goes, Frank.
I lost it. I went halfway down that road and I couldn't come up with it. Hey, listen, our guest is Sean Harrison. He's the master distiller at Plymouth Distillery, where they distill Plymouth gin in England. He joins us today with a great courtesy from across the pond. We'll be back with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Floors, walls, and lighting. The Restaurant Guys learned long ago that the key to making a space look great are floors, walls, and lighting. There's no tougher test to a carpet than a busy restaurant. From design to installation to cleaning, the Gillespie Group has handled the Restaurant Guys restaurant floors for more than 10 years. Designers know what looks great on the first day. Bob Gillespie knows what will continue to look great year after year. Gillespie doesn't just install carpets. Their Quality Clean division has experience and expertise to keep that carpet looking great. In our business, it's the details that matter. In your home or office, the details make a lasting impression. The Gillespie Group handles projects from large hotels to offices right down to your living room. Look down. Go on, look down. Right there by your feet. You see, you need the Gillespie Group. Call them at 732-254-5508 or visit them at thegillespiegroup.com. Tell them the Restaurant Guys sent you and get a free cleaning with any installation. Remember, it's Gillespie for carpet and flooring, 732-254-5508.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guide. This is Francis Schott, and of course, I'm here with Mark Pascal. We own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick. And our guest is Sean Harrison. Now, Sean is one of only 22 master distillers in the world. He's master distillers of gin in the world, and he's master distiller of Plymouth gin in Plymouth, England. Hey, Sean?
Yep.
What's a master distiller, and why are there only 22 of you?
That's a very good question. What is a master distiller? I suppose I'm the keeper of the recipe, if you like, of Plymouth gin, and I think that's what most other master distillers are. We've done, I suppose, we've worked our apprenticeship, we know how to make gin, and we've been given a recipe to look after and to ensure it continues along the line.
Is it a recipe that only you have, that's locked in a secret safe somewhere?
What happens if you get in a car crash or something?
Right, there are two people in the world that actually know how to make Plymouth gin.
What if you're all in the same car?
Well, if you've got an element of knowledge, there is always enough ingredients in the building to see us through about another, 6 months, maybe a year, depending on when the harvest comes in. So if you know what you're doing, you can work it out.
Can you tell us?
I keep bottles of what I've used in the last few years.
Can you tell us what the ingredients are, or is that a secret?
No, not at all. Juniper is obviously the main ingredient. Then we have coriander seed, we have lemon and orange peel, we have something called angelica root. We have something called orris root and cardamom pods.
Now, I just want to reiterate to everybody who says, "Well, I like gin, but vodka, but not gin." You'll drink flavored vodkas. That gin is a flavored spirit. It starts out as basically a vodka that is then flavored with these interesting botanicals. And so,
exactly, yeah, and it's done a lot more subtly. It's not just one flavor; mm-hmm. It's a combination of flavors.
I think that a lot of people have got a bad taste in their mouth from gin because they drank cheap.
Funny.
That's good. Yeah, that's right. And that remember the bad taste in their mouth that they got from gin. From inexpensive gin, which can be very junipery and very heavy and very weighty and almost artificial tasting. And so if that's your experience with gin, maybe you pick up a bottle of Plymouth gin and see the difference when things are done well. Now, talk to us about some gins I know are 100 proof. Some gins I know are much lower proof. What is the relation of alcohol to the way a gin behaves in a cocktail or the quality of the gin?
There's an interesting relationship, really, between alcohol and the way it works, because it's the alcohol that holds the flavor. When you distill, it's the essential oils that attach themselves to the alcohol. So technically, the more alcohol in a bottle, the more flavor there is. But the trouble with alcohol, if you're not careful with it, it can be quite an abrasive, hard substance. And there's a happy medium between flavors holding on to the alcohol and the amount of alcohol you put into a drink. And most cocktails are quite alcoholic, so you've got to be a little bit careful with the level. In all honesty, between 41 and 43 is probably about the best level between flavor profile and alcohol for a bottle of gin.
You know, and so that's very interesting. I think that people don't realize that the amount of alcohol that's in that gin has a direct correlation with the amount of flavor that's there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you guys rely less heavily on juniper and more heavily on some of the other botanicals than a lot of the other gin out there.
What would you consider a very, very junipery gin, and what would you consider a gin that has very little juniper? My choice for the gin with very little juniper would be the Bombay Sapphire. Mm-hmm. That's gin for vodka drinkers.
As you're crossing over from vodka into gin.
And it's a good way to start. It's a fine gin, too.
Bombay Sapphire would be a good way to kind of softly tread that water.
So,
yes, exactly.
So, but then what's the juniperiest of gins?
I would put Gordon's towards that end,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Mm-hmm.
I would put Tanqueray into the citrus bracket along with 10 as a more citrusy style of gin. And we pretty much fall between the two, really, mm-hmm. between sort of the citrus end and the sort of sapphire end, really. We are we've got a bit of both in Plymouth Gin.
If you want to experiment with this, go out. This is, you know, this is a very easy experiment to do. If you want to test your own palate, go out and order a martini if you're a martini drinker, or something that has a significant amount of gin in it, or even ask the bartender to pour you some Plymouth Gin, some Gordon's Gin, and some Bombay Sapphire Gin, and just by smelling it, you'll see how different these things are. They're just bound together by the juniper.
I mean, and what Sean said earlier is, you know, so much of this is in the nose, and so much of what you're tasting comes from the aromatics of what we're doing. And so you'll see those differences right in the nose without even tasting it necessarily most of the time.
Sean, final minute. What's the future of Plymouth Gin?
Oh, quite rosy, really, because as everybody's saying, there's quite a little bit of a backlash going on, really, against vodka, and the fact that you know, gin is sort of making its place in the world again.
Well, that's great.
It's the best, most exciting time to be a gin for probably the last 50 years.
I agree, and gin in cocktails is you know, as people make more and more cocktails at home, it's a very interesting and integral ingredient to a lot of classic cocktails. Hey, Sean, thanks for being on the show.
No, thank you very much.
Very nice talking to you, Sean.
Been a pleasure to have you. Sean joins us from across the ocean, really, in Plymouth, England, where he is a master distiller at Plymouth Gin. Plymouth was sort of the behind-the-bar bottle of old men and me when years ago. I mean, Dale and I used to drink Plymouth Gin, and nobody else was doing it. And now you find it around a lot, and it's kind of trendy, actually. But that's not why you should drink it. You should drink it because it's tremendous. And because it's not so powerful and flavorful, and because it's not on the low end of the spectrum, it makes a great ingredient for a basic ingredient for a cocktail. Well, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, stage left, Catherine Lombardi. Our show today was on gin. These are a few of my favorite things. Gin is great in cocktails, man, and especially in the summertime. There's a magical, magical combination that you may not realize out there that's so easy. Mm-hmm. When you take gin, and this is a cocktail you can make at home. We'll put it up on our website. We actually serve it in the restaurant. It's gin muddled with cucumbers. Mm-hmm. Muddling means you just smash up some cucumbers.
I mean, you could put it in the blender. You could peel it and put it in the blender. And,
oh, stop it, you...
You what?
Can't say that on the radio.
However you want to do it, you can just take the cucumber, strain it out, or you can muddle it in a cocktail like Francis is forcing you to do. But
I'm a control freak.
Gin and cucumber is a great summer combination. Cucumber juice doesn't last real long, 24 hours at the absolute maximum,
and frankly,
I don't recommend it that long.
And that's why I say muddle it. Don't bother putting it in the blender, because it's good. The cucumber juice stays good as long as it's inside the cucumber. So you take a couple of slices of cucumber, and you put it on the bottom of a rocks glass, and you mush it all up, and then you add in maybe a little squeeze of lime and some gin, shake it on the rocks.
Really simple.
Oh,
really
so
delicious.
Good.
Summery.
And you can finish it with a spritz of soda if you want.
Sitting by the
don't
pool.
Even need to.
But, I mean, there's
and Plymouth Gin's a great gin for that.
Few drinks that are more refreshing than
the original.
That in the
we're also going to put up on the website the original drink of James Bond was the Vesper, which was written about in Gary Regan's book recently. Mm-hmm. No, Ted Haig's most recent book was Forgotten Cocktails. We'll put that, which of course we made Vespers for a long time.
Because we didn't forget.
Because we didn't forget. So that was 007's original cocktail before he switched to vodka was the Vesper. We'll put that recipe up there on our web. There's also the Aviation Cocktail. And the Seventh Heaven, which is also in Ted Haig's book.
And obviously there's hundreds and hundreds of other
gin but those are the ones we'll put up, and they're great. They're very strong, though, so be very careful. And remember, the type of gin you use is very important. Plymouth gin is great. Hendrick's gin you can find around is great. Mm-hmm. And you're looking for gin that's not 100 proof. I don't like the 100 proof gins that you find around. And you're looking for and each gin has its own flavor profile and falls to your preference.
And so, again, we talked about this earlier. If you're a vodka drinker and you kind of want to experiment a little bit, try Bombay Sapphire.
Yeah.
Very soft, very easy to drink.
Light
gin
juniper.
With light juniper, it's a good way to kind of cross over from the dark side.
Hope you've enjoyed the hour. Mark and I are going to go have a martini and Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12:00.